my name is Brian Bonsenauer, and this session is going to be on the relative size of things in the universe. So we're going to talk about the size of big things and the size of little things, and sort of how they all relate. And what I hope you can take out of this session is some ways of thinking about the size of things, because truly they are mind-boggling, the relative size of things in the universe. But hopefully by the end of the session you'll have some ways to help think about those, some ways that I found useful. We're going to start with a video called The Powers of 10. And this was a video I think it was in the mid-70s, though I'll have to double check on that for you. And by Charles and Ray Eames, who did a lot of wonderful work both in film and in architecture, in design of many different kinds. There's some wonderful artists, and I think you'll really appreciate their work in this film. But to get into that, I need to give you a little briefing on the logarithmic scale, which is what they use in this film, because they're going to talk about in this film, within the course of, let's see, about 80 seconds, they're going to go from the tiniest, our tiniest understanding of a carbon atom, the nucleus of a carbon atom, out to the edge of the universe, okay? And to make that journey in anything like the time that you could put on a tape, we need to use a different scale than just walking it off in feet. So we're going to use a logarithmic scale to do that. And the logarithmic scale is really fun. It works kind of like this. I'm just going to use some estimates here. If this is our end point here, this black line, then we'll do it in meters, because that works real well for the logarithmic scale. The way that we're going to write the logarithmic scale is in powers of 10, which is the name of the video. And the powers of 10, what that means is we just take 10 and we raise it to different powers. So we could start by raising it to the zero power, and then we can take 10 to the first power, 10 to the second power, 10 to the third power, 10 to the fourth power, etc. So those are powers of 10. You can also go the other way. You could go 10 to the minus 1 power, 10 to the minus 2 power, 10 to the minus 3 power, 10 to the minus 4 power, and so on. You keep going that way. So what do these mean? Well, 10 to the 0 power, anybody know what that is?
1.
1, that's just 1. 10 to the 1 power is?
10.
10, yeah. 10 to the 2 power?
100.
100, I think you're onto it. 3,000.
1,000.
So what is that, what's the power telling you?
How many times you multiply 10 by?
Exactly. So how many times you multiply 10 by itself? So here's 1/10, here's 10 times 10, here's 10 times 10 times 10. What's another way of seeing that? Does anybody see another way?
How many zeros?
Yeah, how many zeros you're talking about. Right. Here there aren't any zeros. Here there's 1, here there's 2, 3, etc. Okay? What about down here? This gets a little strange. What's 10 to the minus 1?
1/10.
Yeah, or let's see, I'll write it two ways. 0.1 or 1/10. How about 10 to the minus 2? 0.01 or 1 over
100.
Exactly so. So we had that same system going on here. I'll just do one more. 0.001 is 10 to the minus 3 or 1 over 1,000. And again, you can think of it as the number of zeros, 1, 2, 3, but now with this decimal between the first zero and the next and the rest, or 1 over 10, 1 over 100. Here there are 2 zeros in that, 3 zeros in that 1,000. Okay? So those are the powers of 10. But we need to get a little better feel for that, what that is, so you can appreciate what's going on in this video. So I did this little diagram here. This is about a meter. So if we're in our, so it's 1 meter, so that would be what power of 10?
0.
10 to the 0, exactly so. Okay? This is about a centimeter here. About between this endpoint and here. So this distance here is about 10 to the minus 1. Or 0.1, no, let's see. Yeah, 0.1 meter.
Point zero one meters.
Thank you. So we need 10 centimeters there to get a good power of 10. That's about in there. So this would be 10 to the minus 1. This would be 10 to the minus 2. A millimeter is barely, it's probably about less than the width of this, but I'll just put it in there, 10 to the minus 3. There. 10 to the... So we've got 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 2, 10 to the 1, 10 to the 0, 10 to the first, or 10 meters is about the width of this room. I pasted off a little earlier. So with powers of 10, if you start counting 0, 1, 2, 3, when I go 0, I'm here, 1 is the width of this room, 2 is 10 rooms, right? 3 is 100 of these rooms. So by just by counting off on your fingers very quickly, you can get really big and really small. There's 1, here's 10 to the minus 1, 10 to the minus 2, 10 to the minus 3. Each integer that you go is 90% of the distance that if I'm going out, I have to go 9. I've only gone 1/10 of the distance that I have to go for the next. And when I'm going in, when I go down from 10 meters, or 10 to the 0 to 10 to the minus 1, I've gone 90% of the way. There are 9 more of these in this thing. Right? So 90%, 90% more, 90% more, 90% more. That's how the logarithmic scale works. And you'll see, what fun stuff you can do with it.
How would a graph, where will we be shown that? How would a graph, showing it on a graph, it goes up pretty fast?
Yes, exactly so. It just gets, it goes screaming up like that. In fact, well, we've talked about that later. Let's see, I get the lights here.
The picnic near the lakeside in Chicago was the start of lazy afternoon, early 1 October. We begin with a scene 1 meter wide, which we view from just 1 meter away.
So there's
now,
10 to the 0.
Now, every 10 seconds, we will look from 10 times farther away, and our field view will be 10 times wider. This square is 10 meters wide, and in 10 seconds, the next square will be 10 times as wide. Our picture will center on the pictures, even after they've been lost to sight. 100 meters wide. The distance a man can run in 10 seconds. Cars crowd the highway. Powerboats lie at their docks. The colorful bleachers where soldiers field. This square is a kilometer wide, 1,000 meters. The distance a racing car can travel in 10 seconds. We see the great city on the lake shore. 10 to the 4th meters, 10 kilometers. The distance a supersonic airplane can travel in 10 seconds. We see first the rounded end of Lake Michigan, then the whole Great Lake. 10 to the 5th meters, the distance an orbiting satellite covers in 10 seconds. Long parades of clouds, the day's weather in the Middle West. 10 to the 6th, a one with six zeros, a million meters. shows a solid sphere.
Here we come.
Not able to see the whole Earth now.
Remember, every new square is 9 times more of that.
A line extends at the true speed of light in 1 second that half crosses the tilted orbit of the moon. Sun. Now the orbital paths of the neighbor planets, Venus and Mars, then Mercury. Entering our field of view is the glowing center of our solar system, the Sun. Followed by the massive outer planets, swinging wide in the big orbits. That outer orbit belongs to Pluto. A fringe of a myriad comets too faint to see completes the solar system.
Still haven't run out of digits yet.
10 to the 14th. As the solar system shrinks to one bright point in the distance, our sun is plainly now only one among the stars. Looking back from here, we know 4 southern constellations, still much as they appear from the far side of the Earth. Squares 10 to the 16 meters, 1 light year, not yet out to the next star. Our last 10-second step took us 10 light years further. The next will be 100. Our perspective changes so much in each step now that even the background stars will appear to converge. At last, we pass the bright star Arcturus and some stars of the Dipper. Normal but quite unfamiliar stars and clouds of gas surround us as we traverse the Milky Way galaxy. Into the outskirts of the galaxy. And as we move away, we begin to see the great flat spiral facing us. The time and path we chose to leave Chicago has brought us out of the galaxy along a course nearly perpendicular to its disk.
There it is.
The 21st. The two little satellite galaxies of our own are the clouds of Magellan. 10 to the 22nd power, 1 million light years. Groups of galaxies bring a new level of structure to the scene. Glowing points are no longer single stars, but whole galaxies of stars seen as one. We pass the big Virgo cluster of galaxies among many others, 100 million light years out. As we approach the limit of our vision, we pause to start back home. This lonely scene, the galaxies like dust, is what most of space looks like. This emptiness is normal. The richness of our own neighborhood is the exception.
Now hold on to your seats.
The trip back to the picnic on the lakefront will be a sped up version, reducing the distance of the Earth's surface to 1 power of 10 every 2 seconds. In each 2 seconds, we'll appear to cover 90% of the remaining distance back to Earth. Notice the alternation between great activity and relative inactivity, a rhythm that will continue all the way to our next goal, a proton in the nucleus of the carbon atom beneath the skin on the hand of the sleeping man at the picnic.
Here comes the sun.
10 to the 9th meters.
It's the moon.
10 to the 8th.
It's the Earth.
7. 6. 5. 4. 3. 2. We slow up at 1 meter, 10 to the 0 power.
Now each step is going to be going
now
slower.
Now we reduce the distance to our final destination by 90% every 10 seconds, each step much smaller than the one before. At 10 to the minus 2, 1/100th of a meter, 1 centimeter, we approach the surface of the hand. In a few seconds, we'll be entering the skin.
It's a millimeter.
Crossing layer after layer from the outermost dead cells into a tiny blood vessel within. Skin layers vanish in turn. An outer layer of cells, felty collagen. the capillary containing red blood cells and a roughly lymphocyte. We enter the white cell. Among its vital organelles, the porous wall of the cell nucleus appears. The nucleus within holds the heredity of the man in the coiled coils of DNA. As we close in, we come to the double helix itself. A molecule like a long twisted ladder whose
random pair
of faces spell out twice, in an alphabet of four letters, the words of the powerful genetic message. At the atomic scale, the interplay of form and motion becomes more visible. We focus on one commonplace group of three hydrogen atoms bonded by electrical forces to a carbon atom. Four electrons make up the outer shell of the carbon itself. They appear in quantum motion as a swarm of shimmering points. At 10 to the minus 10 meters, one angstrom, we find ourselves right among those outer electrons. Now we come upon the two inner electrons held in a tighter swarm. As we draw toward the atom's attracting center, we enter upon a vast inner space. At last, the carbon nucleus. So massive and so small, this carbon nucleus is made up of six protons and six neutrons. We are in the domain of universal modules. There are protons and neutrons in every nucleus, electrons in every atom, atoms bonded to every molecule out to the farthest galaxy. As a single proton fills our scene, we reach the edge of present understanding. Are these some quarks in intense interaction? Our journey has taken us through 40 powers of 10. If now the field is 1 unit, then when we saw many clusters of galaxies together, it was 10 to the 40th, or 1 and 40 zeros.
Take a minute to kind of sit with that. And think about what that what the size of things means to your life. I guess by that what I mean is, how does that inform your life? How does it make a difference to your life to think about that? I mean, at one point in our understanding of the way the world was, the way the universe was, it was much smaller, right? We were much smaller. It was much more intimate. There was the Earth, and then there was a dome over the Earth, and it was all kind of contained, sort of supported and contained. And with this understanding, with our present understanding, this present model of the way the universe is, there's a lot more space there.
It's frightening.
Interesting. And maybe just get with another person who you may not know and tell them your name and think on this question for a minute, just out loud with that other person. Take a couple minutes and do that. What does the size of things mean?
Okay.
Yeah.
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 and that's your phone, Lucy.
It is my phone.
I know Kristen.
If you two want to talk together, that's okay. Even though you know each other.
Can we just be in a...
Sure.
Here's that movie about... The USA.
Why did you say that?
Yeah, right.
Where people still don't believe that.
No, I think that measurement is part of the science. Not in saying why, but in saying how. Well, it changes my life. Because that knowledge, because it seems to me that those same carbon atoms are everywhere. They're in me. So it seems to me that we're all part of the same creation, that we're all made of whatever makes the stars up. Also makes us.
Yeah, because you see that close in, you would think.
So that, I don't know, it's just...
What are you going about science? Question about...
Down to that nucleus and seeing that same kind of space relatively that we saw when we went out of the galaxy, where the space got empty. It's the same way inside us. Well, on size,
it's not so much as we're just so used to this scale, and there's so many other scales.
I love thinking about this.
I think we were able to figure that out.
You're right, about the
more significant.
The power of adding years to them, but
appreciate the bigness of the smallness a little more, because you have a way of describing it. Whereas if you just say, well, it's really, really big, or when you use the word infinite, it's hard to be But when you look at it that way, like going out and standing there and visually just looking at that, and then think of where you're continuing to live, and then where you
Okay. Well, if you finish up your thought on that, we can come back together.
We're all reading everyone's press.
So what kinds of things came out of that? Have some words to describe kind of that sense of what the size of things means to your life, how it feels, what came out of that? Talking about that. I heard some good things going on.
I was just saying that it gives a different perspective on what the word infinite means.
Yeah. And what perspective did you kind of get from that?
Well, I don't know how to describe it, except that when you think in, when you've described it in those mathematical terms,
mm-hmm.
you understand even better how big or how small you're really talking about.
Right.
And then when you think of that as going on forever,
right.
then it truly is mind-boggling.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I think that along those lines, when I was first sort of learning about powers of 10, you know, you can write 10 to the 200 pretty easily. But if those are meters you're talking about, you're outside the known size of the universe. You couldn't draw 10 to the 200 as a length, because there's not enough space in the universe to draw that. So it's there's a sense in which that's, and that's not in terms of infinite, that's not a very big number, 10 to the 200. You could do a lot bigger than that. But it's big. Yeah. Other perspectives. Back here, I heard some stuff about imagining yourself as a pine needle. Something going on about that that was, sounded interesting. What was that about?
Well, we talked about a number of things. I mean, I think what we focused on mostly was the whole question of what's important in the world. That Eric was saying that once you start to think at the level of systems of galaxies and the whole universe, a human-centered or Earth-centered view of what's going on around us seems provincial.
Earth-centered seems what? What was very
provincial?
Provincial. Yeah.
And then I think we were talking a little bit about what it might do for the life of our imaginations. That I expect it's a common experience of you see that drawing of the atom with its shells, and all of a sudden you see the same thing you saw when you studied the solar system, and
exactly.
Sort of the correspondences, which even the video was hinting at, that, you know, that pattern of sort of graininess and emptiness, it helps us to sort of bring this disparity into some sort of unity or pattern.
Right, so try to... Even on the scale of this enormous universe, being able to see sort of a connection and patterns within that. I think this group up here was talking something about that.
Yeah, that we're really part of the whole.
Right.
Physically.
Right, that idea that carbon atom, that's the protons and neutrons in that carbon atom, it's the same stuff that makes up the rest of the universe. In fact, the electrons in your skin, there is no way to tell those electrons apart from any other electron in the universe. There's no way to tell them apart. The best understanding, quantum mechanics understanding of electrons is that they are all the same thing. That every electron is actually the same as every other electron. Not just looks alike, not like identical twins, but the same. The same thing. And that's the best understanding that we have at the moment, which I don't know if I understand it, but there's this tremendous connection between all things. And we talked about that a little bit at a previous session where we were talking about the universe coming out of a single quantum event and everything in the universe expanding out of that quantum event, that there's a tremendous connection between everything in the universe. And we can see that too in looking at the scales of things here. Yeah.
Someone said we're made of star stuff.
Yeah.
I sure like that.
Made of star stuff. It's certainly poetry, but it's also literal reality. That carbon atom in your skin, right there, in that lymphocyte, in your blood vessel, and perhaps will be within a star. That's where that carbon atom was synthesized, was within a star that exploded in a supernova and got caught up in the orbit of the sun. Yeah.
Well, the power to measure and describe and communicate this also leads to the power to manipulate and control. That is, without these measurements, the power wouldn't be there, and then it comes back to who decides.
Right, yeah, so knowledge, well, knowledge is power, that old saying, but it also, this knowledge has ethical implications as well. I mean, once we know this, then we have to decide what to do about it. If carbon is the element of life, all the life that we know of is based on the carbon nucleus, then what does that say about carbon and how we treat carbon? I mean, is there something that ethical response to knowing that carbon is the element that on which life is based? I'm not sure what the answer is to that, but I think the questions, the ethical questions, become with this knowledge, they become paramount as well. Yeah, Eric?
Every time I see a video like this, or even a picture of the Earth and the solar system, I think my initial response, it's not a surprise or anything, but my initial response is always a sense of falling. It's always a sense of like,
right.
We're not grounded, right. Here we're just floating.
Interesting.
I overcome that very quickly, but it's always my initial gut response.
Kind of an ungrounded sense, yeah. That's an interesting perspective on it. Because there's the, go ahead.
Oh, no, perception.
I was just thinking out of that ungrounded is really that experience of, it's really sort of a communion with the idea of gravity. I mean, the Earth as a sphere, again, escaped people for a long time because the sense of being attracted, this gravitational attraction, this mutuality of this gravitational attraction was a hard thing to kind of come to understand.
It also seems so fragile, though.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
It's the right amount of gravity that keeps us in
right.
Its orbit. It's not like gravity holds you on the Earth's surface. It's more fragile.
I was just going to say that I think this kind of knowledge leads to the question, where is God?
Mm.
And the initial response when people began to see the universe from this perspective was that they didn't see God there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where is God?
Mm-hmm.
Because they always pictured God as being there. But I think more and more people now see this is God, or the part about the connection.
Right.
We
right.
are God, or we're all part of. And I think it challenges our theological concepts very drastically.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that completely. And I think there was a lot of resistance to this. I mean, the people died over this knowledge because it did challenge our understanding of who God is and what this means to our lives. And it's taken a lot of time to kind of rethink that and to see God within the connections and within this structure, this amazing structure.
It occurred to me that if God is everywhere, then certainly God is in every carbon and anywhere. So the carbon atoms that we come in contact with, plants, animals, including ourselves, should be treated with great respect.
Mm,
love.
So kind of this re-imaging God. Great. Any last thoughts on that? I want to give you one more sort of tool or way of thinking about the relative size of things that I found helpful. The powers of 10 sort of let us go quickly between scales and look at things from different scales, which can be very helpful. I think it's also kind of a nice mental tool to do sort of size comparisons. And by that, this book has been really fun for me to run across. It's called Imagining the Universe. And the book is based on an idea of using comparisons. The example that he starts with is, what if the Earth were the size of Candlestick Park? So here's the Earth in Candlestick Park. I tried to photocopy this, but it doesn't come out quite so well. That's the beautiful color drawing. Hold on, it's a little better. But the drawing on the book, or the photo on the book, is much prettier. So what if the Earth were the size of Candlestick Park? And we just put the Earth inside Candlestick Park in San Francisco, made it that size. then where would everything else in the solar system be? That's the idea. So think about if we sort of took the whole Earth and made it the size of a baseball park, where would everything else be? And in the book, he goes into a lot of detail about this. I just did some of those to give you an idea here. Here's the solar system. If the Earth is the size of a baseball park, so here's San Francisco right here, and the Earth sitting in Candlestick Park there. And this is the edge of the Pacific Ocean right here in Mexico, down here. So here is, this would be Venus right here. There's the orbit of Venus. It looks like it's in, let's see, was that outside of El Paso or something? No.
It's in New Mexico.
Yeah, it's in New Mexico. Here's Albuquerque. So southern New Mexico there is where Venus would end up. Mercury is down here in southern Mexico, down here. And the sun is off the coast of Costa Rica, down in Central America. The sun is 27 miles across if the Earth is the size of Candlestick Park. 27 miles across.
What about the outer planets?
Right.
Where are they?
Here's Mars, right way up here in the Gulf of Alaska there. So the outer planets, let's see, I think I've got those. No, I don't have those. Here's kind of the outer planets. Nope, that's the wrong one. That's a baseball. So here's the outer planets. Jupiter. Notice the inner planets are all sort of tightly grouped. There's the sun off Costa Rica, the Earth in San Francisco, and Jupiter is way out here. Saturn, way out there.
Neptune off the page.
Yeah, Neptune off the page. So then, if that scale doesn't work, we can go to other scales, but let me show you, he goes through a couple other scales on the Earth the size of a baseball. It's all this baseball theme. And floating over home plate in Candlestick Park, and then showing the scales of everything else. The next one that I thought was interesting that would photocopy was to take the sun, then he goes through the sun, and to get the whole galaxy in there, he had to compress the sun to the size of a grain of sand. So if the sun, which was, when the Earth was the size of Candlestick Park, was 27 miles across, then take that sun and compress it down into the grain of sand. Okay. If the sun is the grain of sand over home plate in Candlestick Park, right there is where the sun is, the size of a grain of sand, then that's our looking at our galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy. That would be the size of it. Here's kind of an Earth-Sun comparison. This is the arc of the Sun here, and here's the Earth here. You can see the Earth down here, and here's the Sun. So there's a relative size of the Sun to the Earth there. I wanted to personalize this a little bit more. So this morning and yesterday I did some walking around here in Holden and found that if the Earth were the size of that bell, all right, our bell out there, here, then the moon would be the size of a grapefruit at the coffee urns there. Okay, so there's the bell, that's the size of the Earth. The moon would be at those coffee urns about the size of a grapefruit.
The ones that are up on the wall?
No, the ones that are inside the door. Yeah, where you get coffee and hot water for tea. The sun would be up at Heart Lake, would be near the middle of Heart Lake, and it would be about twice the size of the dining room. About twice the size of the dining room. That would be the diameter of the sun. if the Earth were the size of that bell up there. So how many people have gone up to Heart Lake? A couple. So you'd have to walk about that four and a half miles up to Heart Lake to get to the sun, if the Earth were the size of that bell. That way. Then the other thing that he does is he goes the other way. So now take a baseball, okay, your standard baseball, and blow it up to the size of a baseball park. So make the baseball the size of, so now we're going in, we're going to the small side of things. Start with the baseball, and imagine that it was the size of a baseball park. Then, over home plate, these would be some of the things that you could see floating around over home plate. Here's a white blood cell. Here's that white blood cell that we saw in the video. That's the size of it. If a baseball were the size of a baseball park, that white blood cell would be smaller than home plate.
If the Earth is the size of a baseball, you're talking
about? No, if a baseball, if you took a baseball and you made it the size of a baseball park. So if you shrunk yourself down, maybe that's what you're thinking about. Okay. Shrink yourself down until you're looking at a baseball and it's the size of a baseball park.
Okay.
Okay? Then if you walked around, here would be some of the things that you see. You know, you come up to home plate and look down, and there would be a white blood cell hovering over home plate. I think this is a sea urchin egg and sperm cells from a sea urchin. And this is a bacteria here. Red blood cell here. Yeah. That's all the ones that I have for that. So he goes through in this session, in this book, going through the scales. One of the things that I think is has been so helpful about that for me is just that a chance to kind of put some common scales on things, to think about the size of things with respect to other things. That can be a real helpful way of dealing it. And you can make that personal in your own experience in that process. And that can be helpful too, to get a handle on the scale of things. So he has several pages on that. In the back of the book, he has some pages with a timeline to try to think about the time of the universe. So he thinks of time as a moving arrow and then looks at how time, if time is progressing, how far away would we be starting at the beginning of the universe out here off the Earth? Here's the beginning of the universe and headed toward San Francisco, toward home plate of San Francisco. If we started way out here at the beginning of the universe, then the first occurrence of human beings coming into San Francisco, into Candlestick Park. We have to go quite a ways. Oh, missed it. There we are. So the first occurrence of humans is right here. Right here. Right around Bayshore Boulevard in San Francisco.
It's headed toward Candlestick. Where was it starting?
This was starting way out here off the surface of the Earth.
Out in space.
Out in space. But here's the size of the Earth then, starting with that. The appearance of Jesus is, I think it's in the center field somewhere here. No. Nope, closer than that even. It's down here. To go go one scale more. Here we go. Kind of, you know, in the inner field there, right in there. Here's home plate, right down here. And appearance of Jesus is about there. That's about 2,000 years ago. Our experience of the Industrial Revolution, the automobile is there. Here's home plate, this thing. Here's the automobile, World War II, and the present right there in the center, home plate. So that can be kind of a helpful way of thinking about time, too. I think he's done a nice job in this, for that journey. Well, I hope that gives you some help in imaging or imagining the relative size of things, finding some of those connections between things. In your hikes around, think about the, as you take steps toward Heart Lake, if you get up there, it's a beautiful hike. Leave the earth at the bell and just walk down to the sun down there. You can have a good hike. And I think that this, these questions about that come up out of that size of the universe are the, for me, the part that has great hope and beauty is this taking this information and re-imaging God within this perspective. This idea of the connection with the rest of the universe, and our place in the universe. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
What questions or other thoughts on that?
Does time move at a constant speed? Is things speeding up? Is it just my life and everybody else's life? Is time down a little? What is it?
Right. The, as far as we can tell, the basis for the models of the universe are based on a principle called the cosmological principle. And it's basically that the universe is about the same everywhere. Now, we can't know this to be true, but because we've only lived in this part of the universe. But it's an assumption. Along with that is an assumption is that time has been the same for all time. So, empirically, there's not a way to test what time was like at the beginning, in the early universe. As far as I've seen in the reading that I've done, the assumption, though, is that the flow of time has been the same.
So it seems like the universe is expanding, mm-hmm. yet technological development is...
Right, you know, right.
Speeding and everything's yeah. getting more compressed in a way. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they're opposites or I'm not.
Well, there is that sense in which there's this complexity that's been developing and it seems to increase in speed right. as things go along. Yeah, and that's I guess that would depend on what you mean by time. Then, you know, if you're measuring time in the rise of complexity, then I think you could say that's compressing. Do you have something to say to that?
Oh, well, along the same lines, I mean, one of the things that I find interesting is the concept of entropy.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is progressing towards more chaos and less order. But one of the concepts of religion is that in the end, things are going to be more order.
Mm-hmm.
In reality, we're actually progressing toward more order, and that, so somehow those two are just
right.
complete opposites,
right.
you know, and they don't jive at all. I don't see how you get the jive, but it's sort of one of my there's so much lost when I think about it.
Right. Well, one of the things that I've does everyone kind of understand that idea? Have people heard about this idea of entropy? It's basically, if I took this vase, I'm not going to do this, it's going to be terrible, but if I took this vase and dropped it, right, and it shattered, then I would be able to put it back together again in the same way.
You would or would not?
Would not. That if I drop it and it shatters, that's a very natural thing to happen. To have the pieces of the vase jump up off the floor and reassemble themselves is never been observed. I mean, that's it hasn't ever happened, but we've never sort of seen that type of thing happen. And so the way that that's talked about is this idea of entropy, that this entropy as kind of a measure of disorder or chaos, that a broken vase is somehow less ordered than that nice vase sitting there. And so the natural course of things is for entropy to increase, to go from a whole vase to a broken vase, and never for it to go the other way, to go from pieces of a broken vase jumping up into a whole vase again. But so that idea that entropy increases, or that observation that entropy increases, is certainly a principle of the scientific study. But also the observation is that we have more ordered systems. I mean, there were always carbon atoms on the Earth, right? But at the beginning of the Earth, there was no life. There was no animals, no plants, no human beings, there were no buildings like this. And these are much more ordered systems than at the beginning of the Earth. I mean, carbon atom is a wonderfully ordered system, but we're, in some sense, a much more ordered system. And so Eric's kind of quandary with that, I think, is something that's a struggle. How is the entropy increasing, but yet we're getting this greater and greater complexity or order in the world?
Well, part of it could be that our people-to-people relationship, person-to-person, has not progressed as far and as fast as science. That is, how people get along with each other, mm-hmm. how they solve problems. And even though social science has been working pretty diligently,
right?
We haven't found out how to prevent wars or to get along on the same piece of land. Mm-hmm. Who decides what? Who gets what?
That's certainly
not as far along as our ability to measure things.
Right.
And deal with them.
That's related to the first question, which is, what's the size of things mean to your life? You're talking about human stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you can think in terms of if you belong to a congregation that has 500 people, how do you view a congregation that has 100 people?
So kind of instead of looking at an individual level, looking at sort of the next larger size of a community?
However you live, I mean, how is that you? See, well, I mean, how I would relate to you, well, my congregation is a much bigger congregation than yours. So we must be doing something right and you're not.
Mm-hmm.
You know how we treat each other.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just using that as one example. You know, you're talking about the size of things in your meaning in life. My father was the same size as my mother. Most men were built a lot taller. How we react to those kinds of things, or how we are I'm sure everybody here knows that a family is a very complicated
bunch
of situations.
Right. So the size of a family versus, when you're talking about the system of a family versus this, an individual. Well, and then the larger communities of, say, a congregation, or going back to your point with getting along with these larger communities, the earth communities. Now you have nations that have to get along. So being able to use that relative size of things to think about things, yeah, I think that's a good point.
I was just going to say, as regarding entropy and disorder that order is a human value and a human concept, at least our, what we think of as order. And so, you know, whether or not that's part of the great plan for there to be more order and for that to, you know, whether that's the best plan, I guess, is beyond our knowing.
Right, right.
You know, it might not necessarily be in the best value to have pots that are together.
Right.
Although it might be best for us holding, right at this moment.
For holding flowers. Yeah, right. Right, that's a good point. The current understanding of where the order then comes from, how we get order if entropy is increasing, is that it comes at the expense of greater entropy elsewhere. For instance, if you go in to clean your room, right? You start with a room that's very messy, and if you straighten it up and put things in order, you've decreased the entropy of that room, but you've also, you know, used a lot of calories. You sort of maybe wasted a whole afternoon, wasted in some sense.
I like that.
And so your entropy increased. You burned a lot of those calories. You turned, you know, food into heat, and that increased the entropy while decreasing the entropy within your room. In a similar way, the earth, system of the earth, is increasing in order at the expense of, or at the increase in entropy of, the photons coming in from the sun. We receive this sort of, as Larry was talking about in a lective the other day, we receive sort of this one-time gift of every day of photons coming in. That's the only thing that comes into the earth from the outside. And the earth absorbs some of those photons and re-emits some of those photons in lower energy states as heat. And in that process, we're increasing the disorder, the entropy of the universe, but in the process of doing that, the earth system creates higher levels of order. So the plants use those photons to grow and change carbon atoms into systems of leaves and food, fruits. We use the stored photons in fuel, and in that process, the Earth system creates higher levels of order. So that's kind of the current understanding of sort of where that order is coming from. It's not that we've sort of suspended this entropy, we're just making use of our place in the sun, so to speak. Yeah. Other thoughts on that?
I just have a question about, and I don't even know how to ask it, but about spaces. Mm. And the reason I was thinking about it is because I was talking to a friend who was describing to me that there is no such thing as empty space. Mm. And that our energy moves beyond our body, just like light from a candle moves out into the room, and you can't say where the light starts and where it ends. And I wonder, I guess I wonder about all of that and what looks like empty space in that, and if it's truly empty, or what is empty.
Yeah, I think that's, again, that's, as we talked about the other day, that there are great mysteries within this scientific story. I mean, there are these deep mysteries, and in some ways the questions that science answers, or the observations that this scientific method has been able to make, only add to those mysteries, only sort of enhance those mysteries. The idea of empty space is one of those, where this space of thinking about space as empty, in the from the scientific model, it's not. I mean, that this empty space is sort of alive with virtual particles coming into existence and going out of existence all of the time. There's sort of this foaming sea of particles.
Well, because even there in space, there's light passing through that. Mm-hmm. If you're able to see a star.
Right.
So it can't be truly empty if there's...
So there are photons coming through and exactly. So that there's a whole sense in which there's not an emptiness out there. I mean, that was, we had talked about that a little earlier, this sort of re-imaging the size of the universe and people saying, oh, there's all this empty space out there, you know, where is God? Well, that space isn't really empty. That space is full, but on a different scale than we're used to thinking about. So there's a whole sense in which to truly sort of know or meditate on the presence of God, we need to think on these different scales to be able to think about that or to meditate on that, to be present to that. Yeah.
You see the size of the universe, is that the size of the light that's going out? Or the size of the actual galaxies that are speeding around?
The size of the universe, yeah, that's a good question. I think when I say the size of the universe, what I mean is the current size of space, of all of space.
So is that defined by the photons that are moving out at the speed of light?
Well, it's defined by the expansion of the universe, of the space itself. That balloon model that we used the other day, that we said that model has some limitations because it's expanding into the room, and space is just, there's no place where it's expanding. The expansion of space is itself. So the photons certainly give us a sense of that, but there are photons out in space that we can't see yet, that haven't come into there hasn't been enough time elapsed for us to see them. So the size of the universe is actually greater than the photons that we can see. Yeah.
This is sort of going back a couple of one or two subjects, but mm-hmm. when we were talking about time, and if it ever varies, is there some way of, we measure time with the speed of light, do we not, mm-hmm. which is a constant? Is there any other way of measuring time except relativistically, or, you know, relative to
right.
time is passing, I'm 68, time is now going by very fast.
Right.
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 Whereas summer used to be an eternity.
Well, there's certainly one of the main sort of insights in the of the work of Albert Einstein was that time is not the constant thing that we thought it was, that the passage of time as experienced is not a fundamental constant in the universe. That there's, depending on your observation and your relative velocity, time can change. Now those effects we don't often experience because that you need to be going an appreciable fraction of the speed of light to experience those.
Is that like the redshift?
It's more than that.
Okay.
Yeah, it's an effect of going at velocities near the speed of light. So we don't often experience those, but I understand your question about the sort of the relative sense of time. I think that you were mentioning something about that too, how things seem to be going faster now. Yeah.
So seem to be.
Yeah.
Is actual.
I think that would be the perspective on it, that it's a seem to be.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But certainly science opens up that question that time is not this fundamental thing. You know, there's something about time that's variable. And so to start questioning into that and look and, you know, sort of that sense of time changing is something that was not considered in the past to be based on reality at all. It was completely a seems to be thing, and now it would be something that would be more accepted, that the time does change, does vary.
It doesn't make any sense.
You're right.
There isn't any time. We create time. Mm. In other words, I have a contract on a job, and I work from, let's say, 9 to 5. Mm-hmm. So, but I create when I start, and we have that much time, et cetera, et cetera, and how we use it. And so, I mean, you know, I can't see where that makes any difference. Mm-hmm. How we use time, of course, can make a big difference in our lives. Mm-hmm. I mean, how we use our own time. I'm sure most people have said, well, gee, and I wasted my time on that. I really could have done something else, blah, blah, blah.
Well, this measure of time is the idea of measuring, say, the distance it takes for light to travel between two places. If you imagine light in a box bouncing back and forth, and each of those bounces is one tick of the clock.
Well, you make some time if you want to make some time.
Right.
You know, who cares if it bounces one or doesn't bounce?
Oh, we have night and day, and we didn't make that. Or the time it takes light to hit the earth.
From the sun.
How long does it take for it?
It's about 8 minutes for the light from the sun to reach the earth.
That's just his opinion.
Well, that's measured.
Yeah. Because they know how fast light goes.
Well, I think thinking about time is the same thing as thinking about space, because we live in this kind of time, in this space, and that's what we have to work with. But understanding, even if we can't travel at the speed of light, understanding that concept gives us a different perspective, I think. I was reading a book about some new kind of physics, and I'm not an expert on this at all, but they were explaining how theoretically that because of curved space-time, the time warps could exist. Mm. And so that theoretically, at least, you know, time could be happening at the same time. You know, this life and your later years in your life or whatever because of time warps. And it, you know, you may probably will never experience that, but thinking of that makes you maybe think of your life differently. Mm-hmm. Or thinking of your life as being all one instead of it being a linear thing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't know, I just think it's interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One, I think that's one of the most helpful things to come out of some of this later science that's been happening is a sense of systems instead of pieces. The idea that to understand things, we can't just look at the pieces. That the pieces, if you just break everything down into its pieces, you reach a point where the pieces. You can't tell anything about the pieces unless you know about the system that they're a part of. So that systems become much more important than just the pieces of systems. Like the piece of my life that's this time becomes much more important thinking about my life as a whole, both the past and the future that will be in my life.
That relates to what I think in my practice, I used to work with families, you know, for big problems. Mm-hmm. And I think of the family as a system. Mm-hmm. And everybody influences.
Right.
One way or another how that system operates.
Yeah.
And therefore, when people came to ask me for help, and even in some cases where everybody came but somebody else didn't come, I refused to see them. Mm.
You need the whole system.
We had only pieces.
Yeah, that creates a whole system. Mm-hmm. And of course, they were very stoned at that. What the hell are you doing here? You
know? Right.
That kind of thing. Yeah. But that seemed to work better.
Mm-hmm.
But the system issue.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody in the village is a family.
Right.
You're a baby.
Right.
Of course a baby.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that's our time here, but
we can leave.
But there is a bigger system of this. I'll be here for a couple weeks, so we'll be talking more about this. So appreciate you all coming, and we'll hope to see you around.